The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 14th, 2019. We are live in Brookings's Falk Auditorium. Congress is back, and amid all the legislative dysfunction, a consensus of sorts is emerging on the need for privacy legislation. Between European pressure, data breaches, and scandals associated with social media manipulation by foreign actors, the idea of some kind of comprehensive privacy legislation has gone mainstream in the last couple years, and members of Congress are hard at work on the idea. But while people agree over the idea of privacy legislation in theory, the substance of that legislation, that is, what a privacy bill would actually do, is fiercely contested. And that's what we're here to talk about, competing visions of what we're trying to do when we talk about comprehensive privacy legislation. We have an amazing panel to discuss it all, a panel that represents a number of different competing visions of privacy legislation. David Hoffman is the Associate General Counsel and Global Privacy Officer at Intel Corporation, and he teaches cybersecurity and privacy policy at Duke. Sally Greenberg is Executive Vice President, is Executive Director, I'm sorry, of the National Consumer League. Yeah, either one. Cam Carey, whom you just heard from, who's now actually on the far left there, is a distinguished visiting fellow here at Brookings and served as general counsel and acting secretary of commerce during the prior administration. And Lydia Parnes is a partner at Wilson Sonsini, where she chairs the privacy and cybersecurity practice. She served as director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection at the FTC. So let's get into it. It's the Lawfare Podcast. What should privacy legislation do? So, Cam, I want to start with the point that you made in your opening presentation, where you said there are a series of issues that reflect a high degree of consensus. And I want to go back even before you get to the issues that are a consensus, and just the question of how this consensus about the need for legislation in the first instance developed. A few years ago, it was a pretty contested idea whether there should be a major piece of U.S. general privacy legislation. Now people seem to agree on it. How did that come about?
So I think there have been a combination of things, and you alluded to them a little bit in the opening statement, Ben. We've had this cascade of data breaches over several years, and particularly, I think, heightened by the Equifax breach, because here's a company that had a lot of impact on people's lives that you know, a lot of people had simply never heard of. And didn't have dealings with. The Snowden revelations really shined a spotlight on the amount of data that's out there. I think the question then was, okay, American companies, can you be trusted to keep our data safe from the government? And then along comes Cambridge Analytica, which just metastasized things, because then the question became, okay, can we trust you with our data? And that has really profoundly changed the landscape. And then in the background of this, of course, you have regulation developing elsewhere. Europe's general data protection regulation. And that sort of moved the bar substantially. And a lot of companies have had to comply with that. And now in the works, the California Consumer Privacy Act. So, and that's both moving the bar and giving businesses an incentive to say, look, let's have one single set of federal rules. So the landscape has been transformed by that. You know, a few years ago, I was going up to Capitol Hill testifying for legislation, and the response I'd get from Republicans and from some Democrats was, what do we need more government regulation for? Now you have people submit, you know, lots of people submitting bills saying we need regulation. And, you know, in the issues that I was outlining, you have lots of business organizations for whom a lot of different kinds of regulation, FTC rulemaking, a number of other things would have been a red line years ago, or say, yeah, we need that.
Okay, so Lydia, I'm interested in whether there is still any theoretical opposition to the idea that Congress should has a major role to play here in a comprehensive sense. Is anybody making the case? Are we now only arguing about the substance of what legislation should contain, or is there still an argument at all over the merits of the idea in the first instance?
So thanks, Ben. And I think Cam's opening presentation set the stage perfectly. I think there is pretty much agreement across the board that this is the time for legislation. And I would underscore a couple of the issues that he just raised. You know, the developments on the state level are pretty compelling in the United States. The idea that we could have we certainly do have will have a privacy law in California that becomes enforceable the first of the year. There are other states that are following suit, and the prospect of having 10, 12, 15 state laws that apply to the collection and use of data and that may impose, you know, somewhat differing restrictions and obligations on companies, I think, is really overwhelming. So I think the notion of the need for a federal uniform legislation is pretty clear. I also think to the point that consumers are concerned about how their data is being used and potentially misused. And companies, particularly consumer-facing companies, they care about retaining the trust of their customers. So I think, you know, I am not aware of anybody who is saying that there's no basis for federal legislation.
Okay, so David, this point that one of the objectives here is to create a uniform standard and prevent a whole lot of differing state rules from regulating the same thing is, I assume, if you're a company that has to operate in a lot of different states, a lot of different jurisdictions, key to the attraction of this. How much is that the driving factor for industry?
I'd say it's half of the driving factor. And it depends who in industry that you're talking with. But I would say, yes, a uniform standard is critically important. The other half, though, is a uniform standard that provides a high protection of privacy for individuals so that people can trust their use of technology and their participation in the digital economy and digital society. That's critical. What you saw in California was a manifestation of people's concerns of knowing that they might be impacted in ways and they wanted to have some way to be protected. It was great that California was able to put something in force. And unfortunately, it's not a particularly strong privacy law. It's really both based on notice and consent. It really puts the burden on the individual to have to protect themselves. I think what folks in industry are saying who are really speaking out about this saying, we need a uniform standard and we need it to be a strong model on privacy that focuses on putting the obligations back on organizations that are processing data to demonstrate that they're behaving responsibly.
All right. So, Sally, at one level, you must be listening to this and saying, as somebody who represents a consumer group that's been arguing for privacy legislation for a long time, you must be saying, you know, welcome, y'all. It's good to see you here. On the other hand, some of the reasons that your co-panelists are articulating for the attraction of this is not consistent with some of the objectives that you would want to accomplish, I think, with privacy legislation. So is the consensus here real, or is it kind of optical?
Well, I would say from a consumer perspective, there has been a drive for the reasons that Cam identified, all of the breaches and the slicing and dicing of information and consumers' growing anxiety about what's being done with their data. Is we need to put some guardrails around the protections that companies are giving individual consumers when they collect our data. And right now we really have almost nothing from a federal perspective. We do have these state bills. We have California. We've got other bills that are emerging in the states that I think are putting, and of course the European model, the GDPR, are putting pressure on the business community to say, we better get going on something, we better put something in place and get ahead of the growing storm. And I do ask myself whether there would be a push from the business community if we didn't have these pieces of law in Europe, the EU law and California and other states coming forward. Having said that, I like what I heard from Lydia about, and I like what I heard from David. The companies actually really do care. Just a few numbers on consumer sentiment on this. This polls extremely high among consumers. 74% of consumers said it's important for them to be in control of who gets information about them and what they do with it. And this is a bipartisan issue. So those are some hopeful points moving forward. I will agree with Lydia, though. Cam laid things out very nicely. We have some areas of agreement, but we have some very tough areas like private right of action and preemption issues to wrestle with.
All right, so let's wrestle with them. Let's keep going with you. If you were the person who gets to write the bill and Congress tomorrow votes on the bill, give us a high altitude sketch of what a piece of privacy legislation that you would like Congress to pass looks like.
Well, you know, we do have a letter that circulated among 34 consumer organizations in November of last year, which highlighted all the principles that privacy and consumer organizations feel are important. Privacy protections must be strong and meaningful and comprehensive. Data practices should protect civil rights, prevent unlawful discrimination, advance equal opportunity, governments at all levels. So you have to have the Federal Trade Commission involved. You have to have state attorneys general involved. You have to preserve private rights of action for violations of whatever law is in place. And there have to be banning of certain kinds of clauses that we see that are ubiquitous in consumer contracts, like forced arbitration. The consumers are in take it or leave it contracts. You're forced to sign away your rights. We don't want consumers to have to sign away their rights to have privacy protections. So those are a list of some of the items that we think are critical in any privacy legislation. And, you know, I can flesh out some of these issues. But, you know, California, as David said, is a notice and consent. But it's got a lot of very nice protections for consumers, including knowing where your data is going and who's using it and what it's being sold for and used for.
Okay, and just to be clear, are there any circumstances in which you would be willing to tolerate preemption of state law as a part of the package? That is, you know, if federal protections are strong enough, are you willing to let industry have the idea that they're only operating under a single set of rules, or is independent state privacy regulation an important principle for you on its own terms?
Well, as Justice Brandeis said in his immortal words, states are the laboratories of democracy. So preemption's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of consumer organizations, although Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky has said, and she's a leader, certainly in the House Commerce Committee, she has said if we get a very strong bill, we could imagine a world in which preemption would be acceptable. But that has a lot of devil in the details, so we can grapple with that as well.
Cam, were you trying to jump in?
Yeah, I did want to jump in on that, because I think I agree with Jan Schakowsky on that, and it sounds like you could get there, Sally, but the question that I had sort of coming out of what you said is, aren't consumers better off assuming strong protections, you know, having one consistent set of rules that they know they're operating under, pretty much regardless of who they're dealing with and where they are?
Well, again, it depends on the level of protections, okay, the strength of protections, whether we've got the Federal Trade Commission's enhanced powers, enhanced funding, whether state AGs can still act on behalf of their constituents, whether we preserve a private right of action. Those are really important principles to most consumer organizations. But I agree with you. I understand the anxiety in the business community of having to comply with 50 different regimes. So let's look at what's most protective for consumers, individual consumers, and let's start there and work our way through some of these difficult issues.
All right. So David, how much of what you just heard is like, well, I can work with that, I can work with that, and how much of it is like, that's not what I mean when I talk about privacy legislation?
Almost all of what you mentioned are things that we can work with, and I think did work with. One thing we did at Intel, because we wanted to move beyond just frameworks and principles, we actually drafted a bill with the help of a bunch of people who are here in the room. I see Pam Dixon and Tim Sparapani and Dan Caprio's here. A bunch of people provided us input. And we think we captured most of those protections, or all of the protections. I will say the one thing that's not in the bill is a private right of action. And I will say I couldn't figure out how to draft it appropriately, and would be open to the conversation.
David,
I'd love to talk about that. I think it's very difficult to do that in a way, because one of the goals of this has to be that we want the use of data has the potential to help us solve some of the most important problems that we have in society. We have examples right now of, because people do not feel that their privacy is protected, they're holding back actually on the use of their data. We actually have the worst of both worlds. We're not properly protecting people's privacy, so we're forcing people to not make their data available in ways that actually could be really good for society. Let me give you an example in the education sector. A lot of parents are holding back on having some of their children's performance in school being used and being able to be accessible, which could be used to personalize learning experiences, because they are appropriately concerned about what the protections are going to be there for the student. What we really need to do is we need to have a law that optimizes for both that innovative use of data by properly protecting people and making sure there's very strong enforcement mechanisms against the bad actors. It's the bad actors, particularly the data brokers, that are creating the situation that real technology companies that want to use data and technology to solve social problems can't.
All right. So you would, but I assume you would insist on preemption as a, I mean, could you guys function in a world in which you don't get state preemption of state law?
Laboratories are great unless you're the living being that's being experimented on, right? And so I don't see how to do this on data privacy without a uniform federal standard.
All right. So, Lydia, how much of this do you listen to and say, this is broadly consistent with a privacy bill that I would support or that that I think is makes sense, and how much of it is, to what extent does your vision of what Congress should do differ fundamentally from any of this?
A couple of points. I'd like to kind of start on the preemption issue, because I think that that's always been That's always been kind of like the game stopper. Years ago, 12, 15 years ago, when I was at the Federal Trade Commission and I testified many, many times on a national data breach notification standard. Now, one would think that would be simple. Have one national standard for when consumers should be notified about when their information has been unlawfully accessed. And there were issues on the margins where it was hard to come to agreement, but the biggest issue was preemption. The biggest issue. And because members of Congress and stakeholders were not able to reach agreement on that, national data breach notification was never adopted. I think it is kind of truly a travesty that that's something that we are still living with, 50 plus laws that have different approaches to breach notification. You know, so I would say on this, I agree with much of what my colleagues here have said. And I have some areas where, you know, I think I do disagree. And other issues that I would put on the table where I think they're kind of tricky. But I would urge that this is an area where we should not let what is perfect in each of our perspectives be the enemy of what we all agree is good. I think we need to achieve the good here. It will be a real positive. So what would I think should privacy legislation look like? International interoperability is important. Companies like David's are operating across the globe, but so are very small companies. And to impose the costs on them of having to comply with very different laws in the U.S. and around the world, very difficult. A privacy law should somehow be tied to the risk of injury. Of some kind of harm to consumers. I think that we would probably all agree with that. I think the devil here really is in the details. What constitutes kind of consumer harm when you're talking about a privacy injury? And I think this is particularly true since the FTC seems to be taking the position that reputational harm is adequate injury on which to kind of proceed in an action. And reputational injury is certainly something that could cause injury, but it's also very subjective. I certainly agree on the, you know, many of the issues that Cam laid out, you know, kind of individual rights, the ability to access correct delete, personal information certainly should be part of a privacy bill, but there needs to be a lot of clarity around this. I would just note the California privacy law is incredibly confusing on this as well as many other issues. And I think data security and data breach notification should be included.
So one question that I wanted to, before we move on to Cam's vision, that I wanted to ask you about specifically is that in Sally's presentation of the principles that consumer groups think are essential, there's several that she mentioned that involve some degree of data handling restriction. I don't have the principles in front of me, but they were suggestive of use restrictions. And I would think that those would be, again, an area where if you express it at a high enough level of altitude, almost everybody would agree. But the moment you bring it down to the sort of granular level of what aren't companies allowed to do, you get into some of those algorithmic questions that Cam was referring to in the opening presentation, where, you know, you're basically potentially banning a lot of companies' business models, which may be, of course, the point, but is also an area where the consensus is going to break down. And I'm curious, to what extent do you think that once you get out of the zone of transparency and uniformity in rules and notification and user control and into the land of substantive use restrictions and collection restrictions on data, the consensus falls apart?
Just taking that, I actually think there's more convergence on use restrictions than might be apparent. I think there's been a lot of work by the FTC over a number of years to articulate what's unreasonable, what then creates risk. I think the area that is actually more difficult than use restrictions is transfer restrictions. And what the responsibilities are for the parties when you are transferring data and making it available to others, I think that's going to be much more difficult to solve.
Do you agree with that, Lydia?
Yeah, so I do. I think they're, and they're very related issues. I think often use restrictions are kind of on the table because to some extent, transparency and choice, which I think, I do think is fundamental. I also understand the argument about too much information. You know, consumers have a lot of information and it's difficult when you're looking at privacy policies if you don't have a law degree or you're not trained in privacy issues to really kind of parse this out and understand what all of it means and make decisions about how you want a particular company to be able to use your information. I certainly understand that. I think the commission, I think many companies have done an excellent job in terms of educating consumers and providing plain language privacy policies and plain language information. I would really, you know, encourage thinking along those lines because I do think that when you get into specific use restrictions, I think the debate will very likely break down. You know, I also think when you get into kind of fairness issues and, you know, kind of equal rights issues and non-discrimination, I would just urge everybody to remember this is a privacy bill. We can't solve all of the problems of the world or all problems that face consumers in the marketplace in privacy legislation. And I think we need to be kind of remember that.
Okay, so that's a really interesting point because for a lot of people, the privacy debate merges with a series of other debates like non-discrimination debates. And I'm curious, Cam, how severable are they really? And do you risk entering into a situation here where if you follow Lydia's advice and you say, hey, this is a privacy bill, it's not a bill about, you know, what real estate companies are allowed to do in terms of selling people houses or, you know, et cetera, you end up fracturing the coalition because people are actually interested in this legislation and this type of legislation for very different reasons. Is it possible to think about this in a narrow context?
I think it's possible. I think there certainly are challenges, but I do agree with Lydia's notion that, you know, we cannot in privacy legislation solve all the problems of our society, but we can ensure that data use does not contribute to those problems. And I think that's a way to focus, I think, on some solutions. So, you know, and you know, my sort of overall vision is that, you know, we should have strong limits, clearly articulated boundaries on collection, on use, and on sharing. And I think to some extent that can affect the discrimination equation because I think some of those limits on sharing have to do with respecting the interests of the individuals that the data is about. And I think that includes not using that data in ways that are discriminatory. So I think through some accountability provisions, so in, you know, sensitive uses of algorithms, doing risk assessments in advance to determine, you know, what is the risk that we will engage in some form of prohibited discrimination here. And then monitoring the outcomes to make sure that that happens. But I think it's also important to this discussion how we talk about discrimination. Discrimination in some respects is what data is about, right? Drawing differences. There are appropriate differences, and there are some that we prohibit. So I think we can say in legislation you can't use the data for prohibited discrimination, but we should not try to sort of regulate every conceivable form of discrimination in that sort of a provision.
So, Cam, before we move on, you gave this admirably neutral presentation at the beginning about the contested issues and the sort of tough decisions that people have to make. And I just want to ask you, what's the right answer? Like, what, you know, if you were giving the non-table setting version of that and say, here's what Congress should do on each of these major contested issues, what does the privacy legislation, according to Cam Carey, look like?
Yeah, well, I think I alluded to that a little bit. It is strong. It is focusing on how data is handled. I think David Hoffman hit the key issue is that we need to move from a model of regulation that's been putting the burden on individuals to manage their own privacy and put the burden on the companies that have the superior knowledge, that are gathering the data, that have tens of thousands of engineers figuring out what you can do with that data. That's way beyond what consumers can understand. So people want control, but I think that control needs to be put in place to some extent by law. And so that means what I talked about, limits on the collection of data, so that, you know, we don't continue the system we have today where, you know, if you're not in a regulated sector, essentially anything goes. And if you can collect it, you know, some people are tempted to go ahead and collect it. Gee, isn't this cool? We can figure out something to do with it and some way to monetize it. Similarly, use of data, how it's retained, and I agree that the key issues become in the sharing of data, because, you know, right now we have an ecology of information sharing that's essentially unbounded, and things like ad tech, data brokerage do have the impact of spreading information around that is enlarging, you know, our cybersecurity risk and individual privacy risk in ways that are unforeseen and uncontrolled.
And is preemption a part of the package?
Preemption is a part of the package. I think if you have strong privacy protections in terms of the boundaries, accompanied by strong enforcement, yes, it should be preempted. I mean, we're talking about the internet here fundamentally. You know, that is quintessentially interstate. And so we should have a national standard there, but a strong national standard accompanied by strong enforcement. But I also, you know, it ought to be sort of agile and adaptive and recognize that, you know, one-size-fits-all solutions don't work, that privacy is contextual. So, you know, strong on the front end, strong on the enforcement, but not too prescriptive in the details. I think individual rights are necessary but not sufficient. Notice is necessary but not sufficient. We do that. I think we have something that's internationally operable and that on the basis of which the U.S. can regain some international leadership in privacy.
Okay, so Sally, as I've been listening to you all talking, one of my reactions has been, wow, this just sounds like the GDPR. And, you know, it's a uniform standard. It's got all kinds of strong protections. It's adaptable in its enforcement because it has, you know, all the different member states each enforcing it the way they feel like it. And so my question is, how different is what you're talking about from GDPR?
Well, you know, there's a lot to like with GDPR because the whole concept behind GDPR is bake data security and privacy into your practices as a proactive matter, and it applies across the board. It applies to companies. It applies to government agencies. Any organization that touches data has an obligation to look into the technologies they use and set privacy-friendly options as a default. So there's a lot to like there. No, it's not perfect. But may I pick up on a point that Lydia made about harm?
Do you mind if I go back.
A quick pivot to that?
Absolutely.
Because a fair point on, you know, we know class action lawsuits can go in a lot of different directions. But what we see today, and one of the reasons why the current or the status quo is intolerable for consumers, is there's these massive breaches. You talked about them, Cam. And what happens when you have, you know, 500 million records taken from Marriott, or in the case of Yahoo, was it, had 2.3 billion records stolen? So what we see on our end from a consumer perspective, we have a fraud center. We have this explosion of identity theft happening because the crooks have all of our information. And who is victimized by that? The most vulnerable people in our society are defrauded out of all sorts of money and goods, and it is a it's a free-for-all. So current situation makes that intolerable. We need to put guardrails around that. Secondly, we've got a situation like family tree DNA. So family tree DNA collects the DNA from their customers as in a contractual situation and decides to turn over 2 million records to the FBI without checking in with their customers. That sent alarm bells around to a lot of us. That is the most private, most personal kind of information. And for a company not to understand, you said many companies have developed very positive and easily understood privacy policies. I'd like to be in those focus groups, and I'd like to have consumers in those focus groups where we have privacy policies delivered to consumers. Because what I see is I get a note in the mail if I decide to open it up in a really skinny envelope, and it says our privacy policies have changed. And sometimes when you read the fine print, it's actually very alarming. We can share your information with anyone that we wish, and we can sell your information. I guess what I'm saying is the status quo is driving the consumer and privacy organizations to say, we need to have some rules around this. Now, as I said, GDPR is a lot to like about it. It's not perfect, but I think we have two very good pieces of law. We have the California law. Let's take a look at that and see what we like and find our areas of consensus. And places where we disagree. Let's look at GDPR. Companies are now, I had dinner yesterday with someone who is with a big company who said, you know, we're ready to adapt to the California law. We've set policies that are in keeping with the GDPR. I know companies are very concerned. Did folks see the letter from the 51 CEOs yesterday to the members of Congress? We need one preemptive national privacy policy standard. So that's, I get that. And I think there's many more areas of agreement here than I thought going in, but we've got a lot of good material to work with. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Lydia, I want to turn that same question to you. How does this consensus reflected here look different from GDPR? And if it's really the same or substantially similar, you know, it's not like the European Commission didn't deal with the devils in the details, right? And so somebody's actually thought through all this stuff. So at the end of the day, are we really just replicating the process that the European Commission went through? Or are we going to come out with a substantially different, you know, set of privacy policies than the European Union has?
It's a great question. I think that when you get into kind of the weeds on the GDPR, it's different. You know, I think one issue that just kind of jumps out at me, the GDPR in particular is very kind of document driven. You have to, and David's shaking his head, yes, and I'm sure he can speak to that, but it requires companies to have documented kind of maps of how their data flows and document all of their policies and practices. Now, that might be good corporate governance for some of it. It certainly makes sense to have kind of policies and procedures in place. But a law that's so heavily focused on, you know, having all of this documentation written, it is incredibly time consuming to do this, incredibly resource intensive. Data mapping in particular can take months and months for larger companies to actually complete this effort. And, you know, I would say good thing to do, great, you know, great to kind of understand how your data is moving around. Maybe more important to think about, as Cam was saying, and Sally, the actual uses. And I think that that's where our debate in the U.S. is really focused. Not so much on, you know, kind of having all of the back end support for what you're doing drafted in every company, but really thinking about kind of the harder issues about the guardrails and how information should be used and whether it should be shared and the extent to which it should be. So I think there will be differences in the U.S. Uh-huh. in terms of the debate.
All right, so I want to ask David a completely unfair question, which is, if I were a cynical person, I'm not, but
was that the question?
I might look at your advocacy on behalf of privacy legislation and say, okay, that makes a lot of sense for Intel because Intel actually has very little skin in the data game, that you guys are fundamentally a chip maker. And so what comprehensive, strong privacy regulation actually is regulate our competitors. And we get all the regulatory certainty, the single rule, but we actually don't do that much use with data. And so my question is the premise there completely wrong and you guys actually have an extensive data collection and use system? Like what is Intel's dog in this fight?
Well, privacy is good for Intel's business.
Why?
Because the more people use technology in innovative ways, the more people are comfortable with their data being processed. New businesses start to feed that demand across education, healthcare, transportation, energy, and the environment. That ends up driving demand for our products when people have trust and confidence in the use of technology. The situation that we have been right now is unacceptable for our society. We have a situation right now, if you are a victim of domestic violence, your attacker for less than $10 can find out your new name and your new address that you're trying to hide from your attacker. If you are a federal judge, people that you convicted of drug crimes, their associates can find out the names and the schools where your kids go. There are data brokers out there who have compiled lists of rape victims. This is unacceptable in our society, and it's reasonable that people in California had the reaction that they had to create a law. We need a federal law. We can't let, as Lydia said, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We know that we have these unacceptable situations, and we know people are holding back from providing the kind of data that could help solve some of our large social problems. That, yes, that would be good for Intel. We think it's going to be good for everybody.
All right. Before we go to audience questions, Cam, with all of this as backdrop, give us a sense of the current legislative landscape. Who are the major players and when should we expect legislative drafts to arise in both houses and when should we expect committees to move them?
So I wish I knew the answer to the last part of that question is, you know, the when part. The key actors, Ben, are the Commerce Committees in both houses. The Senate Commerce Committee in particular has had a group of senior leaders, the chair and ranking member, and some subcommittee leaders who've been at this for a while in a working group. They are drafting and trying to work on bipartisan agreement. And the same process has been going on, the leadership in the House Energy and Commerce Committee. You know, the issues are complicated. I think the real issue here is that, look, there are a lot of people in this room who have been dealing with these issues for a number of years. And I look at around the room and pick out a number of people who have drafted bills and spent a lot of time talking to stakeholders about how to get there. And you know, David Hoffman on our panel has done that. So, you know, they understand the issues, they understand the politics. I think a lot of people in Congress are not there yet. I think there are certainly people who've been engaged in this process for a while, but they've got to socialize with other members and other leaders. And now we have other committees, the Senate Banking Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, also getting into the act. You know, that's a reflection of sort of how this is a hot issue. You know, 2012, 2013, I was knocking on doors on the Hill trying to find partners to work on legislation. I couldn't find any. Now everybody wants in on this.
All right, when I call on you, please identify yourself, state a brief question, state it in the form of a question, and if you can direct it to one of the panelists, that would be great. And if you drone on, I will cut you off with a shocking lack of due process. Sir.
Thank you. I'm Dave Rabinowitz. And for thousands of years, people lived in small villages. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew everything about everybody. And until the growth of cities happened about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, privacy was not something even possible. I'm wondering, is privacy that important, or should we be concentrating on the consequences of breach of privacy? For example, a couple of decades ago, if you were outed as gay, the consequences were pretty severe. Today, it's not such a big deal. Should we be concentrating on keeping information secret, or should we be looking at the consequences of revealing that information, because it's going to be revealed?
Okay, it's an interesting question. Sally, make the case for the for the value being important at all.
Well, I think consumers want to know if their data are being collected and shared. It polls very high. You may not think it's important, and in the Shtetl system, perhaps it wasn't. But we're in a very different world here, where consumers know their data is being gathered and used and perhaps sold to third parties in ways that they don't want and they did not agree to. So this is a... I think it's a real concern about having your data stolen and hacked. We've laid out a couple of egregious examples. This is a critically important issue to consumers, and they want some control over how these data are used. So that's what we're, and I'm encouraged by my panel members who agree it's good for industry, it's good for companies. There's some terrible things that happen when data is too readily accessible. So I would disagree with the gentleman and say, in fact, we're in an era where privacy is very important to consumers, and we, as a consumer community, feel we need to get control over it.
Ma'am?
Yes, Lucia Savage. So in healthcare, for about 20 years, we've had a patchwork of privacy laws, and healthcare seems to be going along. There may be kind of a retarded effect on interoperability. Can you talk a little bit about why a nationwide law is so important and why businesses can't accommodate state-by-state laws or preserving state laws that are already in place?
I'll just add something that maybe others would. I would say healthcare is not going along. The patchwork has not worked in the healthcare area. The idea that we've segmented off data that is subject to HIPAA versus data that is provided in other contexts that could be useful. There's so much that we could do if we had a better structure around the processing of data in the healthcare area to create better clinical results for individuals, spur better advances in healthcare research and drug development. It's to me a classic case where the patchwork has not worked and needs to be modernized.
Sir?
David Medin, former FTC and PCLOB. A suggestion and a question. And the suggestion is on preemption. Why not sunset preemption? 20 years ago, under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, preemption was put in with a sunset. And when it sunsetted, a lot of consumers got a lot out of the debate at the time of sunset, including free credit reports. Why not make it, instead of making it permanent, why not have 3 to 5 years of preemption of state law and see how it works out? And my, I guess, question is, isn't this time to declare consent dead? We have based a lot of our models on consent. We could survey this room. Everyone has a smartphone, which dozens of apps. How many have people in the room have ever read any of their apps' privacy notices, yet their information is being collected, stored, transmitted on a minute-by-minute basis? Shouldn't we be 100% focused on use and disclosure in any new legislation?
Ken, do you want to
take that? Yeah, I think we should be significantly over 50% focused on use and not on consent and disclosure. I think by and large that has become a fiction. And in fact, Michelle Richardson, who that I was leading the second panel here today, the CDT bill that she and others drafted, has no role for consent. I could see perhaps a limited role for consent for certain sensitive data, certain sensitive uses, but I think it's challenging to think through, all right, what is that consent form going to look like? What's going to be the user interface? So I think I agree with the thrust of the question, absolutely.
Lydia, can I just ask you on the preemption question? I think this is an interesting, provocative idea. Could you bridge the preemption gap by saying, yes, preemption, but for some limited period of time, and then we have to see how it's working after that?
Right. So David always has provocative suggestions. I think it's interesting. I also think it's challenging because I think that if we're not able to reach any agreement on preemption, I kind of think moving that may be a way to kind of break through a logjam on this. I think it would be better to be able to just kind of reach agreement on it. But yep, I will take my own advice. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
What do you think, Sally? You expressed possible openness to preemption under some extreme set of circumstances. Could those extreme circumstances include that you only have 5 years of it?
Well, as I'm sitting here listening to the discussion, I'm getting more optimistic that we can do this because there's so many areas of agreement. But I'm thinking about your preemption issue. I think it's very interesting. It's creative. One possible way to do that is to flip that and say, okay, let's let states have a few years to pass their own bills. We'll have a federal standard. We'll have a federal bill. In that period of time, if states want to come in and act and they don't like or they don't think the federal bill is strong enough or they think it's too strong, let them come in. If they don't act within a year or two, then we have a federal preemption scheme. So I think all these ideas are very worth discussing, debating, and thinking about. And if that breaks a logjam for us, you know, either flipping it or in the way that David described it, preemption for 5 years, I think we need creative ideas on the table to move this forward.
David, you had a quick point on consent.
Just really quick, David, I direct you to what we did on consent with Intel's bill. It's posted at usprivacybill.intel.com. There's a lot of commentary from experts there. And what we did is we still didn't recognize, like, I love with my iPhone when it asks me to consent for sharing of location data or something. We want to encourage companies to find innovative ways like that to actually make it so that individuals can consent while we recognize in the great bulk of situations they're not going to. So 100% no, but let's figure out incentives to have it happen.
We have time for one more question.
Well, I think I'm
going to
piggyback on that. I am a little skeptical to when corporations ask Congress to provide some oversight and write a bill regulating their activities. That seems a little questionable to me. I would question the intent, particularly when we are hearing conversations about the idea of consent being dead, which gives the impression that corporations believe that they should have more control over a person's information than they do. And in the introduction, we heard that parents were not sharing data that might be helpful in educational context because they were concerned about that information being shared. And so when you see that consumers, parents, are withholding information because they are concerned about how it's going to be used, how it's going to be shared, to me, that's an argument that you should have more instances where people are allowed to consent, when people are given notice about how you intend to use and disseminate their information. And so I think that it is corporate sponsored when we say that consent is dead and people don't care about the information that apps are collecting on their phones.
All right, so I will defend David Medin against the charge of corporate sponsorship. I think you raise a very interesting point, which is like, how do you get over, you have a sort of grand coalition that includes a big chunk of industry that's thinking about this. How do you get over the skepticism You know, I'll direct this to you, Sally. How do you get over the skepticism that, you know, industry is coming in and sort of co-opting the idea of privacy legislation in order to basically create a cool, good working climate for industry?
Yeah, and I share that skepticism. So that's why you need voices like consumer organizations saying, "Hey, wait a second. We agree with you on that we have to have guardrails and regulations and how these data are used, and consumers need to have the ability to know where their data is going, and if you're willing to give consumers that information, then we've, you know, moved down the road. They need to be able to delete their data." They need to know who it's being sold to and to say, no, I don't want my data sold. And a greater sense of control, not checking off, I waive my right to control my data, which industry is very famous for putting all of those kinds of waivers in our agreements. Forced arbitration, I want to have a remedy if you violated the rules that you set out for yourself and the rules that we have in these laws. If you violate them, I have a right to take you to join with others to go to take you to court for class action, not be shoved into an arbitration setting that you guys control. So industry's going to have to go the extra mile to convince us that this is something that you think is both good for you, is good for your customers, and it gives consumers the kind of control they want, at the same time giving you a uniform landscape for what the rules and regulations are, and not a patchwork of 50 different states.
We are going to leave it there. Please join me in thanking our panel.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. This week is a good example of why you need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast, to buy lots of Lawfare merch. You need to rate us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Podtrac, whatever you use, and you need to share us on social media. I want you to tweet about this episode of the Lawfare podcast. And I want you to listen to every piece of music that Sophia Yan, who is playing the music to take us out of this episode, has ever recorded, because Sophia Yan has been playing the Lawfare podcast music since the beginning of the Lawfare podcast. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.